It's nice to see everyone here today. We'd like to once again welcome our visitors. We'd like for you to consider yourselves our honored guests while you're here with us. We're very pleased that you came to worship our Father in heaven with us today. For those of us who are members of the congregation here, it's the first Sunday morning of the month, and you guys know what that means, right? That means back to our annual theme. And remember when we started this year off, we sort of took a look at Old Testament history and we sort of divided it up into 12 sections. And so each first Sunday morning of every month, I'm preaching a lesson taken from a narrative that happens during one of these time periods. So in January, the very first section of Old Testament history was what? You guys remember? We're going back to saying it at the beginning of ever. We're all going to say it together. The first one is pre-flood, right? Okay. The second one is post-flood, right? The third one?
Yeah.
Patriarchal. Okay. The fourth one, bondage, right? Which represents the time period in which Israel was under bondage and slavery to Egypt. The fifth one, wandering, right? The 40 years of wandering during the wilderness after the misreport of the spies and their botched invasion attempt. The sixth one, right, the 5 years of Joshua's war of conquest over the fortified cities in Canaan. Number seven, Judges, right? The 350-year or so time period in which deliverers ruled over Israel and God raised them up to help solve some of the domestic problems they were having that were a result of their idolatry and their repeated unfaithfulness to God. So after the judges' time period was over, we had last month United Kingdom, right? And so we looked at a narrative of the United Kingdom. We looked at the life of David, right? And some things that happened during his lifetime. And so this morning we're going to be talking about divided kingdom. Right, there we go. That's going to be our time period this morning. Next month, we will talk about Judah alone. After the northern kingdom of Israel is destroyed in 722 BC by the Assyrian Empire, the nation of Judah remains among the descendants of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob in the promised land alone by themselves. And so after that, in November, we will be looking at captivity, the 70 years of captivity in Babylon under first the Babylonian and then later the Medo-Persian Empire after the Babylonians were overthrown by the Medes, who were then succeeded by the Persians. And so in December, the first Sunday morning of December, we'll be talking about restoration, the restoration of Israel back into their promised land, going there, how under the Emperor Cyrus, they were allowed to return to their homeland to rebuild Jerusalem, to rebuild the walls around the city, and to rebuild the temple. So, this morning, we are talking about the divided kingdom. And what I want to do this morning is I want to narrow in on one sequence of events, one narrative, the life of one person, some things that happened in his life. And I want it for us to be specific and to really dig into it. This is something that I hear talked about and I hear mentioned occasionally. And it might just be because I'm only 32, but I've never actually heard a sermon devoted entirely to this narrative. Not yet. So I figured, hey, I'll do it. I want for us to consider the events of 1 Kings chapter 12 this morning. So everybody turn there if you would. And when we go to 1 Kings chapter 12, we talk about the divided kingdom and all the bad things that happened during that time period. When we go to 1 Kings 12, we usually go to the back end of that chapter, right? Because we love to talk about Jeroboam and his idolatry and the golden calves of Dan and Bethel. As a matter of fact, I've done a couple sermons about that myself, so I know we like to talk about it, at least I do, because it's rich with lessons and moral application for each and every single one of us. But what I want to deal with today is I want to deal with the earlier verses of the chapter. I want to talk about what led to that in the first place. How did Israel even get there? And what was the process by which all of this happened? And I want to deal not with Jeroboam, but I want to deal with Rehoboam. Because whenever we talk about the divided kingdom, most of the time we go off into the northern kingdom of Israel, right? And we talk about Jeroboam, we talk about Omri and Zimri and Ahab, we talk about Jehu, and we talk about all those kings. But somehow, the kings of the southern kingdom occasionally get left behind. So I want to talk about them today. I want to talk about the first king of Judah as an independent nation on its own, separate from Israel. I want to talk about Rehoboam. Rehoboam is one of those interesting characters to me that there's actually quite a bit said about him in Scripture, yet sometimes, for some reason, I feel like we may not talk about him enough. Because what is said is actually pretty big, and it's quite important. There's a lot of things to do when we talk about Rehoboam. When we talk about him, we're dealing specifically with the very beginning of his reign here, how it started off. And in order to set that up, we have to set some context. We have to talk a little bit about his father Solomon. Now, we're actually studying Solomon in our Sunday morning Bible class here in the auditorium. And one of the things that we have not yet gotten into is Solomon's building projects. Solomon was famous for his construction. Most of us know he built the temple, right? The first temple. I mean, we talk about that quite a bit, right? What a lot of us may or may not know is that Solomon didn't just build the first temple. Solomon built all over Israel. He had massive construction projects. He built roads in his kingdom. He built gates and walls around many of his cities, especially the ones that were on the frontier, the border cities. He built walls around them. He built gates. He fortified them. He strengthened them. As a matter of fact, archaeologists have uncovered gates that are inscribed as having been built by Solomon all over Palestine, and walls of cities that have inscriptions built by Solomon, built by Solomon, built by Solomon. Solomon was a builder. He was an expander of his nation's borders. But he worked through diplomacy and he worked through trade, not through the sword. He dominated people with his economic savvy and capabilities. But in order to build all of these great public works, in order to build these roads, in order to build these cities, to fortify them, to strengthen them, to keep them strong, and to make sure his nation stayed important and powerful, what do you need for that? You need money, right? You need money. Where does the government's money come from? Taxes. It comes from the people. It comes from the people. That's exactly where it comes from. It comes from taxes. And Solomon had to tax his people in order to engage in these public work projects. And so he did tax his people, and he taxed them, and he taxed them fairly heavily. And Solomon was building and building and building and building and building all up until the day he died. But on the day he died, his nation was large, it was secure, the borders were strong, and it was fairly prosperous, in spite of the heavy taxation. And so Rehoboam comes to this throne, and the kingdom is not yet divided. When we think of the last king of the United Kingdom, we think of Solomon, right? Actually, technically, Rehoboam is the last king of the United Kingdom. Because what we're going to study today is how the kingdom and why the kingdom splits. The very ending of the United Kingdom and the very beginning of the divided kingdom. And so it's in this context that we find the events of 1 Kings chapter 12. So upon taking the throne, and upon settling into power and position himself, he actually does something that appears to be very wise. I'm going to start reading in verse 6. Then King Rehoboam took counsel with the old men who had stood before Solomon his father while he was yet alive. The very first thing he does is he gathers his father's counselors around him, and he asks this question. How will you advise me to answer this people? And the answer that he's looking for is an answer to the question that the people themselves had posed. And those are the first five verses. So now what we're going to do is we're going to go back and read that. Rehoboam went up to Shechem, for all Israel had come to Shechem to make him king, to celebrate his coronation as the son of Solomon, as the grandson of David. And as soon as Jeroboam, the son of Nebat, heard of it, for he was still in Egypt, where he had fled from King Solomon, then Jeroboam returned from Egypt, And they sent and they called him and Jeroboam and all of the assembly of Israel. And they came and they said to Rehoboam, your father made our yoke heavy. This is the taxation we spoke of earlier. Your father made our yoke heavy. Now therefore, lighten the hard service of your father and his heavy yoke on us, and we will serve you. And the implication is, and serve you gladly. So he said to them, go away for 3 days and then come again to me. So the people went away. And it's during these 3 days that that Rehoboam asks Solomon's counselors, his father's counselors, to advise him, what should I say? How should I deal with these people? What am I going to do? So the old advisors, they said to him, verse 7, if you will be a servant to this people today and serve them and speak good words to them when you answer them, then they will be your servants forever. They laid out the principle, well, you scratch my back, I'll scratch yours. This is the way the world works, Rehoboam. This is very common understanding, but also keep in mind, these people have been taxed very, very, very heavily. Does anyone in this country ever like a president who raises taxes? No. What about presidents who lower taxes? Well, it kind of depends, right? Depends on whether or not we get the lowering, right? Because if our taxes get lowered, we love it. But if it affects other people, not us, we don't really care, or else we actually might not like him that much. Now, verse 8 says, he abandoned the counsel that the old men gave him, and he took counsel with a young man who had grown up with him and who had stood before him. Rehoboam's fall is tragic because it's predictable, because it's human. And the very first thing he does is he rejects wisdom. We work a certain way as human beings, right? We all share common needs. We all share common desires. And that's what Solomon's advisors are trying to explain to Rehoboam, is that in these three verses, they lay out, it's actually pretty simple. If you want the people to serve you, if you want the people to be faithful to you, then yes, lower their taxes, because the things that your father did are done. We don't need them anymore. We don't need to be taxing the people because we don't need to be doing any of those things right now because all the building has been done. You can actually lower the taxes and it's going to be okay because we don't need that much revenue anymore. But I find verse 8 to be particularly poignant. He abandoned the counsel of the old men and gave... that the old men gave him, and he took counsel with a young man who had grown up with him and stood before him. It's funny because I say this from my lofty height of 32. What Rehoboam does here is something that all of us have done at some point in our lives. When we think of those who are older than us, what do we think of? How do we perceive them? How do we view them? What is our mental construction that we have of the elderly? It depends on who you ask, right? Depends on who you ask. And it depends on how far along they are on their walk of understanding and wisdom in life. I'm not going to say age, because sometimes that actually doesn't matter. But it depends on how much they've grown in wisdom and understanding. I want to share a few verses from how God tells us we should view those who have survived for longer than we have. Turn to Leviticus. Put your marker back here in 1 Kings 12 if you have one, or keep your finger here, or whatever you want to do. But go back to Leviticus chapter 19, if you would. Leviticus chapter 19 is probably my favorite chapter of Leviticus. which is sort of an odd statement in and of itself, because how many of us have a favorite chapter in Leviticus? Right? It's kind of one of those books that's just full of a bunch of you shall do this, you shall not do this, right? But I love chapter 19. I love it. I love it to death. It's a wonderful chapter. And it contains so much that's rich in principle of how we go about this thing that we call being human. Verse 32 is what I want to look at right now. You shall stand up before the gray head and honor the face of an old man. That has to do with listening to what he has to say. You shall fear your God. I am the Lord. It's an interesting statement. In Proverbs chapter 20, verse 29, Solomon himself, the father of this man, Rehoboam, has this to say. Chapter 20, verse 29 of the book of Proverbs. Solomon writes this. I was looking at chapter 21, verse 29. No wonder it didn't look right. The glory of young men is in their strength, but the splendor of old men is their gray hair. That's an interesting turn of phrase, especially in a culture that values youth and idolizes youth, that hair coloring products are no longer sold for ladies alone, are they? Right? Just for men. The thing that I find fascinating is that there's that product that they have, the touch of gray, that still gives you a little bit of that gray look. I think that's fascinating to me, that there's this, for men it's okay to walk the line between old and young, right? But we idolize youth, right? How many of us like to hear you look old? How many of us like to hear that? You look old. There's this movie that my wife and I love because it's so much like us and it's so much like our different families. And it's a culture clash romance story. It's great, it's funny. There's a lot of moments in it. But the father says to the daughter in their one culture, he says to her, and he wants her to get married because she's 30 and she's not married yet. Oh no. But he says to her, he says, "You look so old." But the thing is, looking old, it's actually, in the eyes of God, a valuable thing. So one last verse I want to consider before I sort of put all this into context. Job. In chapter 12, these are the words of Job. In verse 12, he says, "Wisdom is with the ages, and understanding in the length of days." Now, I understand. This is a generalization, right? It's not always absolutely 100% true. Because I've met some people that are quite advanced in years, and they seem as lost as a 16-year-old sometimes in understanding wisdom. And then I've met some 18-year-olds that have their head pretty much screwed straight onto their shoulders and know what's what in life. There's always exceptions, but the general rule is that these things are actually pretty true. Especially when we start talking about the culture and the context of when these things are written. Because these people lived in an agrarian society where hard manual labor was the order of the day. And where very few children actually survived to become adults. In some parts of the world, before modern medicine, occasionally the mortality rate of children under the age of 10 was 50%. Half of your children would survive to grow past 10. And if they survived to 10, they were pretty much good until some accident or something happened or they died of old age. So when you see a man with gray hair, what it means is that he's managed to survive for a long time. And that means he has skills and he has knowledge and he has understanding. And the thing is, in a culture like that, that ought to be very obvious, right? Where life is hard and life is difficult and it takes toil and it takes acquiring knowledge to make the ground grow in years where it's bad and you have no rain. And so you listen to what they say and you pay heed when they speak. But we don't live in an agrarian society today. So those rules don't apply to us, right? Because now old people don't have the knowledge like that, do they? I mean, that's how we sometimes tend to think. But the truth is, so I'm learning this the older I get, right? The older I get, the more I realize that people older than me know more than me. There's a quote by Mark Twain. I've said this before, probably on Wednesday nights in Bible class occasionally. You guys probably heard this from me over and over again. But Mark Twain said something absolutely brilliant once. And he said it when he was older. He said, "My father has the highest learning curve of any man in existence. When I was 18, he knew absolutely nothing. I was astounded to find out how much he had learned by the time I turned 25. That was Mark Twain. That's sort of classic Mark Twain. It's the way he wrote, the way he spoke. Lampooning the hypocrisy of society with humor. But this whole perspective regarding those who are older of us and a devaluing of what they have to say is actually rooted in something else. It's rooted in one thing, and that's what I want to talk about next. How we get to this point of rejecting the advice that Scripture gives us here. The next thing that happens in the narrative, starting in chapter 9, or chapter 12, verse 9 of 1 Kings, back to 1 Kings now. So he said to them, these are his younger advisors, right? His friends, the people that grew up with him, his peers. They said to him, "What do you advise that we answer this people who have said to me, 'Lighten the yoke that your father put on us'?" And the young men who had grown up with him, they said to him, "Thus you shall speak to the people who said to you, 'Your father has made our yoke heavy, but lighten it, so but you lighten it for us.' This is what you should say to them: 'My little finger is thicker than my father's thighs. Now whereas my father laid on you a heavy yoke, I will add to your yoke. My father disciplined you with whips, but I will discipline you with scorpions.'" He embraced foolishness. That here in this narrative, the next few verses, what we find is we find good, sound advice being completely and utterly rejected because those people don't know what they're talking about. How dare these people come to you with this problem and ask you for this? What you ought to do is you ought to punish them, to teach them not to come to ask you with these things. Proverbs chapter 22, verse 16. Again, Solomon, the father of this man, Rehoboam. He writes this. "Folly is bound up in the heart of a child, but the rod of discipline drives it far from him." This is something that's actually hitting home with me a lot right now. Because most of you guys know Aria. She's two. I got a cute, adorable little bundle of troublemaking joy. That's what I got. And she's at home sick right now. And I'm like, normally I stay and I talk like for a long time. I'm going to be out the door almost right away after services are over. I'm going to get home to my kid. But when you have a two-year-old, you learn a lot about the human race. You do. Because a two-year-old is raw. They're not affected by the cultivating of the culture around them yet. They don't have any of that conditioning. They're not taught racism yet. They're not taught arrogance or superiority. They are a pure distillation of what human beings are at their core. They're kind. They're selfish. They're honest. And they lie. Right? That pretty much sums up a two-year-old pretty well, right? They can be incredibly kind. And you guys know how sweet Arya can be. What you don't see is sometimes how selfish she can be. Because she's usually on her good behavior for you guys here at church. For which I am eternally grateful. But they're honest and they say things. And then, you know, when they get old enough and they learn, they start getting in trouble for some things. Did you do that? No. Come on, don't tell me that. They are who we are, deep down inside, before our learning process has modified our behavior. Sometimes, toddlers do foolish things. When we're folding blankets after doing the laundry, Arya wants us to throw them over her head. She thinks that's funny. She loves it. She loves having a blanket thrown over her head for some reason. So we were doing that one day, and then the next thing she did, she took off running. And she ran face first right into the wall. Folly is bound up in the heart of a child, not paying attention to where you know things are, because this is our apartment, this is where we live, she knows where all the walls are, but she's not paying attention to it, and she runs headlong into it. Because she's caught up in her surroundings and in what's happening to her right in that moment and all the fun that she's having. And she's not aware. And she's not mindful of her surroundings. In Proverbs chapter 13, Solomon writes this in verse 20. He says, "Whoever walks with the wise becomes wise. But the companion of fools will suffer harm." In Proverbs chapter 3, the first four verses, Solomon says this again. All this is directed to the very man who spurned all this advice. Behold the great irony of Rehoboam's life. The balance of Proverbs is directed from Solomon to Rehoboam. He says, "My son, do not forget my teaching, but let your heart keep my commandments. For length of days and years of life and peace they will add to you. Let not steadfast love and faithfulness forsake you. Bind them around your neck. Write them on the tablet of your heart, so you will find favor and good success in the sight of God and man. Faithfulness, love, compassion, mercy." I mentioned earlier that Leviticus 19 is my favorite chapter of Leviticus. Verse 18 in Leviticus 19 is the very source of one of the greatest commandments that Jesus taught his disciples. "You shall love your neighbor as yourself." Leviticus chapter 19, verse 18. "You shall love your neighbor as yourself." And that's what Rehoboam did not do. He rejected this and embraced the folly of a self-centered existence. So, the consequences of his pride are recorded for us in the verses following. So Jeroboam and all the people came to Rehoboam the third day, as the king said, "Come to me again the third day." The king answered the people harshly, and forsaking the counsel that the old men had given him, he spoke to them according to the counsel of the young men, saying, "My father made your yoke heavy. I will add to your yoke. My father disciplined you with whips, but I will discipline you with scorpions." So the king did not listen to the people, for it was a turn of affairs brought about by the Lord that he might fulfill his word, which the Lord spoke by Ahijah the Shilonite to Jeroboam the son of Nebat. And when all Israel saw that the king did not listen to them, the people answered the king, "What portion do we have in David? We have no inheritance in the son of Jesse. To your tents, O Israel. Look now to your own house, David." So Israel went to their tents, but Rehoboam reigned over the people of Israel who lived in the cities of Judah. Then King Rehoboam sent Adoram, who was the taskmaster over forced labor, and all of Israel stoned him to death with stones. And King Rehoboam hurried to mount his chariot to flee to Jerusalem. So Israel had been in rebellion against the house of David to this day, by the time these books were written. And when all Israel heard that Jeroboam had returned, they sent and they called him to the assembly, and they made him king over all Israel. And there was none that followed the house of David, but the tribe of Judah only. The crown is broken, and the nation is divided. In the book of 1 Corinthians, chapter 13, or chapter 15, Paul quotes Gentile, pagan playwrights on a couple different instances in that chapter alone. And one of the occasions upon which he quotes these pagan playwrights, he does so in a proverbial sense. Do not be deceived. Bad company ruins good morals. Verse 33. Bad company ruins good morals. All of these things happened to Rehoboam because of one choice, who he listened to. Who he listened to. And here's the whole thing. We look at this and we look at, and what's our very first thought, our very first comparison when we have this, is who do we often address this verse to? Who do we bring this verse up? When we're talking to our kids, right? We bring them out to junior high schoolers. We bring them out to high schoolers, right? No. I'll be the first to say that that's an age group that could use this lesson, that needs this lesson. Absolutely, desperately needs this lesson, because that's an age group that is very vulnerable to peer pressure in a lot of ways. Now, here's the thing I want to point out about this verse. This verse is not saying we can't have pagan friends. It's not. It's not saying we can't hang out with non-Christians. It's not. And sort of the interesting thing is, because he's quoting a pagan poet, he's actually not even saying that they don't have good things to say every now and then. They do. But what he's saying is they can't be the foundation of the source of guidance in our lives. There's a book that I read that I think is actually quite good. It's called The Dumbest Generation. And it's talking about millennials. And we love to, those of us who are, I'm of the generation that immediately precedes the millennials, but I'm not a part of them. And we love, those of us who are not millennials, love to pick on them because they're absorbed in their cell phones all the time. I have a cell phone, but I don't have it out all the time. And there's all these other things that go on, and there's this, one of the points he makes is there's this hyper-connectivity between children these days and their peers, and the more you're connected to these people, the more you look to them for guidance. And when you look to your peers for guidance, and he's primarily talking about school-age people, when you look to your peers for guidance, that's when things go wrong. But I want for us to actually take a step back from looking at this and directing it toward junior high schoolers and high schoolers, not that they don't need it, they do. Go through this with them at home. But I want for us to take a step back and ask ourselves the question, how old was Rehoboam when he did this? You guys know? Dude was 41. 41! Now, if I ask Carla, and I ask her, is 41 young, she's going to say, yeah, right? But most of the rest of society would say, especially when you're living in an agrarian society, and most people are dead by 70, 41 is middle-aged. Okay? Let's be honest. 41 is middle-aged. And what that tells us is that the things that we typically tend to think of as youthful problems, as the problems of the young and the pressures of the young, and the things that young people have to do to stay pure in the eyes of God, they're not for just young people. They're for people. We do this all the time. How many of us get advice from our peers? More often than not. How many of us do that? Yeah. I submit that might not be such a great source of advice. One of the reasons we have this wide range of diversity within a congregation is so we can ask people who aren't us. Because if you got a group of people who all were brought up in the same circumstances, all have the same context and the same background, they're all going to have the same thoughts and the same ideas, and sometimes they might be bad. So you've got all these people who are just like you telling you, oh, that's a good idea, that's a good idea, that's a good idea. And then, just like Aria, you run face first into the wall with a blanket over your head. I mean, we laugh, but it's actually not that funny. Classic example, true story. There's a congregation that I know of where there's a man who's a good friend of mine who I was pretty close to when I was there, and who I've maintained some contact with since now, who is not living with his wife. She was, for some reason, feeling unfulfilled in their marriage. I don't know why. But she didn't address that with her husband. But she talked to the women she worked with about it. You know what they told her? Leave him, go find fulfillment, go find happiness somewhere. And as a result of listening to her co-workers and her peers, she has unfortunately had two affairs, which explains why he's not living with her anymore. And I don't blame him a bit. That's what happens. I'm going to tell you, they have children in college. This is not a problem that affects the young alone. This is a problem that affects people. This is a problem that affects all of us. Because when we allow ourselves to be influenced by our peers, what happens is we only get one voice. There's only one voice. But do you wonder what Solomon said about wisdom and where it comes from? He also said this. In a multitude of counselors, there's good advice. The reason we have all these different people that we surround ourselves with is so we can look to all of them for guidance. More importantly, even more important than looking to other people for guidance, there's one source that Solomon forgot to inquire of. And it's one that he should have remembered because his father tried to beat this into his head over and over and over again. Because what did Solomon say about wisdom in Proverbs and Ecclesiastes? The fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom. Rehoboam, more than anything else, forgot to ask God. And that is the first place we should go to. Because that's who we are as his people. He is our Father, who we respect, whose advice we heed, whose counsel we listen to. He is our Lord, whom we obey. He is our master whom we serve as slaves. He is our covenant ruler. If you haven't yet dedicated your life to this, and you'd like to make this pledge to serve God and to serve him alone and to look to him for all things that you need in this life, we'd encourage you to do so. If you'd like to, to be immersed in water, to be forgiven of your sins, and enter into a covenant with him. If there's anything else that we can do, anything we can offer you at all, please come forward and let us know what it is as we stand and sing the song that's been selected.